Would he deliver to apes earlier than humans?
Interesting point, sir. Possibly you're referring to my theory that humans may have in fact descended from apes, of course, said Ponder. A bold hypothesis which ought to sweep away the ignorance of centuries if the Grants Committee could just see their way clear to letting me hire a boat and sail around to the islands of...
I just thought he might deliver alphabetically, said Ridcully. There was a patter of soot in the cold fireplace. That's presumably him now, do you think? Ridcully went on. Oh, well, I thought we should check. Something landed in the ashes. The two wizards stood quietly in the darkness while the figure picked itself up. There was a rustle of paper.
Let me see now.
There was a click as Ridcully's pipe fell out of his mouth.
Who the hell are you? He said. Mr. Stibbons, light a candle.
Death backed away.
I'm the Hogfather, of course. Ho, ho, ho. Who would you expect to come down a chimney on a night like this, may I ask?
No, you're not.
I am. Look, I've got the beard and the pillow and everything.
You look extremely thin in the face.
I'm not well. It's all, yes, it's all this sherry and rushing around. I am a bit ill.
Terminally, I should say.
Ridcully grabbed the beard. There was a twang as the string gave way. It's a false beard.
No, it's not, said Death desperately.
Here's the hooks for the ears, which must have given you a bit of trouble, I must say.
Ridcully flourished the incriminating evidence.
What were you doing coming down the chimney? He continued. Not in marvellous taste, I think.
Death waved a small grubby scrap of paper defensively.
Official letter to the Hogfather, says here, he began, and then looked at the paper again. Well, quite a lot, in fact. It's a long list. Library stamps, reference books, pencils, bananas.
The librarian asked the Hogfather for those things, said Ridcully. Why?
I don't know, said Death.
This was a diplomatic answer. He kept his finger over a reference to the Arch-Chancellor. The orangutan for Duck's Bottom was quite an interesting squiggle.
I've got plenty in my desk drawer, mused Ridcully. I'm quite happy to give them out to any chap, provided he can prove he's used up the old one.
They must show you an absence of pencil?
Of course. If he needed essential materials, he need only have come to me. No man can tell you I'm an unreasonable chap.
Death checked the list carefully.
That is precisely correct, he confirmed,
with anthropological exactitude.
Except for the bananas, of course. I wouldn't keep fish in my desk.
Death looked down the list and then back up at Ridcully.
Good,
he said, in the hope that this was the right response. Wizards know when they are going to die. They generally know in time to have their best robe cleaned, do some serious damage to the wine cellar, and have a really good last meal. It's a nicer version of death row, with the bonus of no lawyers. Ridcully had no such premonitions, and to Ponder's horror, prodded Death in the cushion.
"Why, you," he said. "What's happened to the other fellow?"
"I suppose I must tell you."
In the House of Death, a whisper of shifting sand and the faintest chink of moving glass, somewhere in the darkness of the floor, and in the dry shadows the sharp smell of snow and a thud of hooves. Sidney almost swallowed his tongue when tea time appeared beside him.
"Are we making progress?" "I'm sorry," said tea time.
Sidney recovered himself.
Some, he said. "We think we worked out, one lock."
Light gleamed off tea time's eye.
"I believe there are seven of them," said the assassin. "Yes, but they're half magic and half real and half not there. I mean, there's parts of them that don't exist all the time."
Mr. Brown, who had been working at one of the locks, laid down his pick.
"It's no good, mister," he said. "Can't even get a purchase with a crowbar. Maybe if I went back to the city and got a couple of dragons, we could do something. You can melt through steel with them if you twist their necks right and feed them carbon."
"I was told you were the best locksmith in the city," said Tea Time.
Behind him, Banjo shifted position. Mr. Brown looked annoyed.
"Well, yes," he said, "but locks don't generally alter themselves while you're working on them. That's what I'm saying."
"And I thought you could open any lock anyone ever made," said Tea Time.
"Made by humans," said Mr. Brown sharply, "and most dwarfs. I don't know what made these. You never said anything about magic."
"That's a shame," said Tea Time. "Then really I have no more need of your services. You may as well go back home."
"I won't be sorry," Mr. Brown started putting things back into his tool bag. "What about my money?"
"Do I owe you any?"
"I came along with you. I didn't see it's my fault that this is all magic business. I should get something."
"Ah, yes, I see your point," said Tea Time. "Of course you should get what you deserve. Banjo?"
Banjo lumbered forward and then stopped. Mr. Brown's hand had come out of the bag holding a crowbar.
"You must think I was born yesterday, you slimy little bugger," he said. "I know your type. You think it's all some kind of game. You make little jokes to yourself and you think no one else notices and you think you're so smart. Well, Mr. Teacup, I'm leaving right now, with what's coming to me, and you ain't stopping me, and Banjo certainly ain't. I knew old Ma Lilywhite back in the good old days. You think you're nasty? You think you're mean? Ma Lilywhite'd tear your eyes off and spit 'em in your eye, you cocky little devil. And I worked with her, so you don't scare me, and nor does little Banjo, poor sod that he is."
Mr. Brown glared at each of them in turn, flourishing the crowbar. Sidney cowered in front of the doors. He saw Tea Time nod gracefully, as if the man had made a small speech of thanks.
"I appreciate your point of view," said Tea Time, "and I have to repeat, it's Te'a Tim'e. Now, please, Banjo."
Banjo loomed over Mr. Brown, reached down, and lifted him up by the crowbar so sharply that his feet came out of his boots.
"Here, you know me, Banjo," the locksmith croaked, struggling in midair. "I remembers you when you was little. I used to sit you on my knees. I often used to work for your ma."
"Do you like apples?"
Banjo rumbled. Brown struggled.
"You got to say yes," Banjo said.
"Yes."
"Do you like pears?" "You got to say yes."
"All right, yes."
"Do you like falling down the stairs?"
Medium Dave held up his hands for quiet. He glared at the gang.
"This place is getting to you right, but we've all been in bad places before, right?"
"Not this bad," said Chicken Wire. "I've never been anywhere where it hurts to look at the sky. Oh, gives me the creeps."
"Chick's a little baby, nyeh, nyeh, nyeh,"
sang Cat's Eye. They looked at him. He coughed nervously. "Sorry, don't know why I said that."
"If we stick together, we'll be fine."
"Eeny, meeny, miny, moe,"
mumbled Cat's Eye.
"What? What are you talking about?"
"Sorry, it just sort of slipped out." "What I'm trying to say," said Medium Dave, "is that if Peachy keeps making faces at me..."
"I didn't."
"Liar, liar, pants on fire."
Two things happened at this point. Medium Dave lost his temper and Peachy screamed. A small wisp of smoke was rising from his trousers. He hopped around, beating desperately at himself.
"Who did that? Who did that?"
demanded Medium Dave.
"I didn't see anyone," said Chicken Wire. "I mean, no one was near him. Cat's Eye said, pants on fire, and next minute..."
"Now he's sucking his thumb,"
Cat's Eye jeered.
"Nyeh, nyeh, nyeh, crying for mummy. You know what happens to kids who suck their thumbs? There's this big monster with scissors all..."
"Will you stop talking like that?"
shouted Medium Dave. "Blimey, it's like dealing with a bunch of..." Someone screamed high above. It went on for a while and seemed to be getting nearer, but then it stopped and it was replaced by a rush of thumping and an occasional sound like a coconut being bounced on a stone floor. Medium Dave got to the door just in time to see the body of Mr. Brown, the locksmith, tumble past, moving quite fast and not at all neatly. A moment later, his bag somersaulted around the curve of the stairs. It split as it bounced, and there was a jangle as tools and lockpicks bounced out and followed their late owner. He'd been moving quite fast. He'd probably roll all the way to the bottom. Medium Dave looked up. Two turns above him, on the opposite side of the huge shaft, Banjo was watching him. Banjo didn't know right from wrong. He'd always left that sort of thing to his brother.
Poor guy must have slipped, Medium Dave mumbled.
Oh, yeah, slipped,
said Peachy. He looked up too. It was funny. He hadn't noticed them before. The white tower had seemed to glow from within, but now there were shadows moving across the stone, in the stone.
What was that? He said. That sound.
What sound?
It sounded like knives scraping, said Peachy. Really close.
There's only us here, said Medium Dave.
What are you afraid of, attack by daisies?
Come on, let's go and help him.
She couldn't walk through the door. It simply resisted any such effort. She ended up merely bruised, so Susan turned the doorknob instead. She heard the "Oh God" gasp, but she was used to the idea of buildings that were bigger on the inside. Her grandfather had never been able to get a handle on dimensions. The second thing the eye was drawn to were the staircases. They started opposite one another in what was now a big round tower, its ceiling lost in the haze. The spirals circled into infinity. Susan's eyes went back to the first thing. It was a large, conical heap in the middle of the floor. It was white. It glistened in the cool light that shone down from the mists.
"It's teeth," she said.
"I think I'm going to throw up," said the Oh God miserably.
"There's nothing scary about teeth," said Susan. She didn't mean it. The heap was very horrible indeed.
"Did I say I was scared? I'm just hung over again. Oh, oh me."
Susan advanced on the heap, moving warily. They were small teeth, children's teeth. Whoever had piled them up hadn't been very careful about it either. A few had been scattered across the floor. She knew because she trod on one, and the slippery little crunching sound made her desperate not to tread on any more. Whoever had piled them up had presumably been the one who'd drawn the chalk marks around the obscene heap.
"There's so many," whispered Bilious.
"At least 20 million, given the size of the average milk tooth," said Susan. She was shocked to find that it came almost automatically.
"How can you possibly know that?"
"Volume of a cone," said Susan. "Pi times the square of the radius times the height, divided by 3. I bet Miss Butts never thought it had come in handy in a place like this."
"That's amazing. You did it in your head?"
"This isn't right," said Susan quietly. "I don't think this is what the tooth fairy is all about. All that effort to get the teeth and then just to dump them like this. No. Anyway, there's a cigarette end on the floor. I don't see the tooth fairy as someone who rolls her own." She stared down at the chalk marks. Voices high above her made her look up. She thought she saw a head look over the stair rail and then draw back again. She didn't see much of the face, but what she saw didn't look fairy-like. She glanced back at the circle of chalk around the teeth. Someone had wanted all the teeth in one place and had drawn a circle to show people where they had to go. There were a few symbols scrawled around the circle. She had a good memory for small details. It was another family trait. And a small detail stirred in her memory like a sleepy bee. "Oh, no," she breathed. "Surely no one would try to..." Someone shouted, someone up in the whiteness. A body rolled down the stairs nearest her. It had been a skinny, middle-aged man. Technically, it still was, but the long spiral staircase had not been kind. It tumbled across the white marble and slid to a boneless halt. Then, as she hurried towards the body, it faded away, leaving nothing behind but a smear of blood. A jingle noise made her look back up the stairs. Spinning over and over, making salmon leaps in the air, a crowbar bounded over the last dozen steps and landed point first on a flagstone, staying upright and vibrating. Chicken Wire reached the top of the stairs, panting.
"There's people down there, Mr. Teatime," he wheezed. "Dave and the others have gone down to catch them, Mr. Teatime."
"Te a tim e,"
said Teatime, without taking his eyes off the wizard.
"That's right, sir."
"Well," said Teatime, "just do away with them."
Yeah, one of them's a girl, sir."
Teatime still didn't look round. He waved a hand vaguely.
"Then do away with them politely." Yes, mister, yes, right."
Chickenwire coughed.
"Do you want to find out why they're here, sir?"
"Good heavens, no. Why should I want to do that? Now go away." Chickenwire stood there for a moment and then hurried off. As he scurried down the stairs, he thought he heard a creak. as of an ancient wooden door. He went pale. It was just a door, said the sensible bit in front of his brain. There were hundreds of them in this place, although, come to think of it, none of them had creaked. The other bit, the bit that hung around in dark places nearly at the top of his spinal column, said, "But it's not one of them, and you know it, because you know which door it really is." He hadn't heard that creak for 30 years. He gave a little yelp and started to take the stairs four at a time. In the hollows and corners, the shadows grew darker. Susan ran up a flight of stairs, dragging the Ogod behind her. "Do you know what they've been doing?" she said. "You know why they've got all those teeth in a circle? The power. Oh, my!" "I'm not going to," said the head waiter firmly. "Look, I'll buy you a better pair after Hogswatch."
"There's 2 more choux pastry, 1 for puree de la terre, and 3 more tourte à la boue," said a waiter hurrying in.
"Mud pies," moaned the waiter. "I can't believe we're selling mud pies. And now you want my boots."
"With cream and sugar, mind you. A real taste of Ankh Morpork. And we can get at least 4 helpings off those boots. Fair's fair. We're all in our socks."
Table 7 says the steaks were lovely but a bit tough," said a waiter rushing past.
"Right. Use a larger hammer next time and boil them for longer."
The manager turned back to the suffering head waiter. "Look, Bill," he said, taking him by the shoulder,
"this isn't food. No one expects it to be food. If people wanted food, they'd stay at home. Isn't that so? They come here for ambience, for the experience. This isn't cookery, Bill. This is cuisine, see? And they're coming back for more."
"Yeah, but old boots.
Dwarfs eat rats," said the manager, "and trolls eat rocks. There's folks in Hawanderland that eat insects, and folks on the counterweight continent eat soup made out of bird spit. At least the boots have been on a cow."
"And mud?" said the head waiter gloomily.
"Isn't there an old proverb that says a man must eat a bushel of dirt before he dies?"
"Yes, but not all at once." "Bill," said the manager kindly, picking up a spatula.
"Yes, boss?" "Get those damn boots off right now, will you?"
When Chickenwire reached the bottom of the tower, he was trembling, and not just from the effort. He headed straight for the door until Medium Dave grabbed him.
"Let me out! It's after me!"
"Look at his face," said Cat's Eye. "Looks like he's seen a ghost."
"Yeah, well, it ain't a ghost," muttered Chickenwire. "It's worse than a ghost."
Medium Dave slapped him across the face.
"Pull yourself together. Look around, nothing's chasing you. Anyway, it's not as though we couldn't put up a fight, right?"
Terror had had time to drain away a little. Chickenwire looked back up the stairs. There was nothing there.
"Good," said Medium Dave, watching his face. "Now, what happened?"
Chickenwire looked at his feet.
"I thought it was the wardrobe," he muttered. "Go on, laugh."
They didn't laugh.
"What wardrobe?" said Cat's Eye.
"Oh, when I was a kid."
Chickenwire waved his arms vaguely.
"We had this big old wardrobe, if you must know. Oak. It had this... this... on the door there was this... sort of... face."
He looked at their faces, which were equally wooden.
"I mean, not an actual face. There was a... all this decoration around the keyhole, sort of flowers and leaves and stuff. But if you looked at it in the right way, it was a face. And they put it in my room because it was so big, and in the night.
They were grown men, or at least had lived for several decades, which in some societies it's considered the same thing. But you had to stare at a man so creased up with dread.
"Yes," said Cat's Eye, hoarsely.
"It whispered things," said Chickenwire, in a quiet little voice, like a vole in a dungeon.
They looked at one another.
"What things?" said Medium Dave.
"I don't know. I always had my head under the pillow. Anyway, it's just something from when I was a kid, all right. Our dad got rid of it in the finish, burned it, and I watched."
They mentally shook themselves, as people do when their minds emerge back into the light.
"It's like me in the dark," said Cat's Eye. "Oh, don't you start," said Medium Dave. "Anyway, you ain't afraid of the dark. You're famed for it. I've been working with you in all kinds of cellars and stuff. I mean, that's how you got your name, Cat's Eye. Sees like a cat."
"Yeah, well, you try and make up for it, don't you?" said Cat's Eye. "'Cause when you're grown, you know, it's just shadows and stuff. Besides,
It ain't like the dark we used to have in the cellar.
Oh, they had a special kind of dark when you was a lad, did they? Said Medium Dave. Not like the kind of dark you get these days, hm?
Sarcasm didn't work.
No, said Cat's Eye simply. It wasn't. In our cellar it wasn't.
Our mam used to wallop us if we went down to the cellar, said Medium Dave. She had a still down there.
Yeah, said Cat's Eye from somewhere far off.
Well, our dad used to wallop us if we tried to get out. Now shut up talking about it.
They reached the bottom of the stairs. There was an absence of anybody, and any body.
He couldn't have survived that, could he? Said Medium Dave.
I saw him as he went past, said Cat's Eye. Necks aren't supposed to bend that way.
He squinted upwards.
Who's that moving up there?
How are their necks moving?
Quavered Chicken Wire.
Split up, said Medium Dave. And this time, all take a stairway. Then they can't come back down.
Who are they? Why are they here?
Why are we here? Said Peachy. He started and looked behind him.
Taking our money after us putting up with him?
Yeah, said Peachy, distantly trailing after the others. Do you hear that noise just then?
What noise?
Sort of clipping, snipping.
No, no. No, you must have imagined it.
Peachy nodded miserably. As he walked up the stairs, little shadows raced through the stone and followed his feet. Susan darted off the stairs and dragged the O-God along a corridor lined with white doors.
I think they saw us, she said, and if they're tooth fairies, there's been a really stupid equal opportunities policy.
She pushed open a door. There were no windows to the room, but it was lit perfectly well by the walls themselves. Down the middle of the room was something like a display case, its lid gaping open. Bits of card littered the floor. She reached down and picked one up and read, Thomas Ague, aged 4 and nearly 3/4, 9 Castle View, Stow Lat. The writing was in a meticulous rounded script. She crossed the passage to another room, where there was the same scene of devastation.
So now we know where the teeth were, she said.
They must have taken them out of everywhere and carried them downstairs.
What for?
She sighed. It's such old magic, it isn't even magic anymore, she said. If you've got a piece of someone's hair, or a nail clipping, or a tooth, you can control them.
The O-God tried to focus. That heap's controlling millions of children?
Yes, adults too by now.
And you could make them think things and do things?
She nodded.
Yes.
You could get them to open Dad's wallet and post the contents to some address?
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but yes, I suppose you could.
Or go downstairs and smash all the bottles in the drinks cabinet and promise never to take a drink when they grow up, said the O-God, hopefully.
What are you talking about?
It's all right for you. You don't wake up every morning and see your whole life flush before your eyes.
Medium Dave and Cat's Eye ran down the passage and stopped where it forked.
You go that way, I'll...
Why don't we stick together, said Cat's Eye.
What's got into everyone? I saw you bite the throats out of a couple of guard dogs when we did that job in Quirm. Want me to hold your hand?
You check the doors down there. I'll check them along here.
He walked off. Cat's Eye peered down the other passage. There weren't many doors down there. It wasn't very long, and as Tea Time had said, there was nothing dangerous here that they hadn't brought with them. He heard voices coming from a doorway and sagged with relief. He could deal with humans. As he approached, a sound made him look round. Shadows were racing down the passage behind him. They cascaded down the walls and flowed over the ceiling. Where shadows met, they became darker. And darker. And rose and leapt.
What was that? Said Susan.
Sounded like the start of a scream, said Bilious.
Susan threw open the door. There was no one outside. There was movement, though. She saw a patch of darkness in the corner of a wall, shrink and fade, and another shadow slid around the bend of the corridor. And there was a pair of boots in the centre of the corridor. She hadn't remembered any boots there before. She sniffed. The air tasted of rats, and damp and mould.
Let's get out of here, she said.
How are we going to find Violet in all these rooms?
I don't know. I should be able to sense her, but I can't. Susan peered around the end of the corridor. She could hear men shouting some way off. They slipped out onto the stairs again and managed another flight. There were more rooms here, and in each one a cabinet that had been broken open. Shadows moved in the corners. The effect was as though some invisible light source was gently shifting.
"This reminds me a lot of your grandfather's place," said the O-God.
"I know," said Susan. "There aren't any rules except the ones he makes up as he goes along. I can't see him being very happy if someone got in and started pulling the library apart." She stopped. When she spoke again, her voice had a different tone. "This is a children's place," she said. "The rules are what children believe."
"Well, that's a relief."
"You think so? Things aren't going to be right. In the Soul Cake Ducks country, ducks can lay chocolate eggs, in the same way that Death's country is black and sombre because that's what people believe. He's very conventional about that sort of thing. Skull and bone decorations all over the place. And this place,
pretty flowers and an odd sky.
I think it's going to be a lot worse than that. And very odd, too."
"More odd than it is now?"
"I don't think it's possible to die here."
"That man who fell down the stairs looked pretty dead to me."
"Oh, you die, but not here. You, let's see. Yes, you go somewhere else, away. You're just not seen anymore. That's about all you understand when you're three. Grandfather said it wasn't like that 50 years ago. He said you often couldn't see the bed for everyone having a good cry. Now they just tell the child that Grandma's gone. For 3 weeks, Twyla thought her uncle had been buried in the sad patch behind the garden shed, along with Buster and Meepo and all three bulges."
"Three bulges?"
"Gerbils. They tend to die a lot," said Susan. "The trick is to replace them when she's not looking. You really don't know anything, do you?"
Hello?
The voice came from the corridor. They worked their way round to the next room. There, sitting on the floor and tied to the leg of a white display case, was Violet. She looked up in apprehension, and then in bewilderment, and finally, in growing recognition.
"Aren't you..."
"Yes, yes, we see each other sometimes in beers, and when you came for Twyla's last tooth, you were so shocked that I could see you, I had to give you a drink to get your nerves back," said Susan, fumbling with the ropes. "I don't think we've got a lot of time."
"And who's he?"
The O-God tried to push his lank hair into place. "Oh, he's just a god," said Susan. "His name's Bilious."
"Do you, drink at all?" said the O-God.
"What sort of question?"
"He needs to know before he decides whether he hates you or not," said Susan. "It's a god thing."
"No, I don't," said Violet. "What an idea. I've got the blue ribbon."
The O-God raised his eyebrows at Susan. "That means she's a member of Offler's League of Temperance," said Susan. "They sign a pledge not to touch alcohol. I can't think why. Of course, Offler's a crocodile. They don't go in bars much. They're into water."
"Never touch alcohol at all?" said the O-God.
"Never," said Violet. "My dad's very strict about that sort of thing."
After a moment, Susan felt forced to wave a hand across their locked gaze.
"Can we get on?" she said.
"Good. Who brought you here, Violet?"
"I don't know. I was doing the collection as usual, and then I thought I heard someone following me, and then it all went dark, and when I came to, we were... Have you seen what it's like outside?" "Yes." "Well, we were there. The big one was carrying me, the one they call Banjo. He's not bad, just a bit odd, sort of slow. He just watches me. The others are thugs. Watch out for the one with the glass eye. They're all afraid of him, except Banjo."
"Glass eye?"
"He's dressed like an assassin. He's called Tea Time. I think they're trying to steal something. They spent ages carting the teeth out. Little teeth everywhere. It was horrible. Thank you," she added to the O-God who had helped her onto her feet.
"They've piled them up in a magic circle downstairs," said Susan. Violet's eyes and mouth formed three O's. It was like looking at a pink bowling ball.
"What for?"
"I think they're using them to control the children by magic." Violet's mouth opened wider.
"That's horrid."
"Horrible," thought Susan. The word is horrible. Horrid is a childish word selected to impress nearby males with one's fragility, if I may judge. She knew it was unkind and counterproductive of her to think like that. She also knew it was probably an accurate observation, which only made it worse. "Yes," she said.
"There was a wizard. He's got a pointy hat."
"I think we should get her out of here,"
said the O-God, in a tone of voice that Susan considered was altogether too dramatic. "Good idea," she conceded. "Let's go."